Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through the underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. On June 15th, 2015, the California legislature passed California Senate Bill 277. It was signed by the governor of California on June 29th, 2015. And the law, which does not take effect until July 1st of this year, removes the personal belief vaccine exemption for children attending daycare and public and private schools. Education for California public and private school children and daycare will be dependent upon students receiving the federally recommended and state mandated vaccines, regardless of a parent's personal or religious belief objections. Today's show is part two of our discussion about vaccine facts and fallacies. And I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. Gary E. Forsman, a physician with over 25 years of experience in clinical practice of internal medicine and integrative medicine, and the founder of Middle Path Medicine in Arroyo Grande. Jessica Joslin is a physician's assistant with Middle Path Medicine, and Johanna is a mother of four. And I want to thank you all for being here with me today.
It's great to be here.
Kind of, you know, this has been a topic that certainly in the news media and just even at dinner conversations, you can get some really clear differences in opinions. So I appreciate you coming in and sharing yours with us. Our show is live today, and we invite you into our conversation with your comments or questions. And you can do that by calling us at 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. And Dr. Forsman, I'll start with you because you are a physician.
Correct.
An internist, and you kind of made a transition away from the traditional medicine model into what you're practicing now. Can you talk a minute about how that happened?
Certainly. I've been on the Central Coast for over 20 years now. My training is at the University of Florida Medical School, and then I stayed at UC Irvine for my internal medicine residency fellowship, and I've been a faculty involved in clinical research, and so obviously have a great deal of background in terms of what does the science say about vaccines, what does the science say about their safety as well as what their efficacy is. And so Middle Path Medicine is just what I found so often in this world is that you'd say Western medicine says one thing and natural medicine says the other thing, and truth is somewhere in the middle. And I was saying that about everything, and I would say the same thing about vaccines as well. And for the brief part that I could listen to the previous show on vaccines, I find it uniquely interesting that anybody who's involved in science, who appreciates the scientific method, doesn't know. I found that when people claim to know what to do here, they obviously can't know, because that wouldn't be science. And so there's a lot of science that refutes many of the things that have been said out there, even on this one show. And I found it fascinating because I could only listen to so much. because the science out there is confusing. And so if people out there are confused, good for you, because if you read enough about almost anything, you should be confused. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to do is say, hey, there is room for debate out there. Mm-hmm. But then if there's this room for debate, you know, why are things being mandated to us? Why are things being forced down our throats, if you will? And mm-hmm. and that, I've found that to be the most compelling reason to speak out, because it's a fear-driven system. And so many people are afraid, and I understand it. There's a lot of fear in this world. But we're trying to get past the fear and try to see the reality of things, and that science, the beauty of the scientific method, it's an ongoing thing, and we can have conversations about what the benefits of vaccines are and the negatives, and hopefully we can have that today in an open, kind of caring way.
Great. I appreciate it, and I look forward to that conversation. And I wanted to talk about physician assistant, too, Jessica, because that's, you know, a lot of people are familiar with the term nurse practitioner, but are not familiar with physician assistant. Can you give me a quick overview of what that is?
Yeah, a physician assistant is very similar to a nurse practitioner in the things that we can do, especially in the state of California. Mm-hmm. There almost identical. Our backgrounds are very different. Nurse practitioners are brought up in the nursing model, and physician assistants or primary care associates are brought up in the medical model. So we're trained and brought up by doctors. Essentially, we do exams, diagnose, treat, give you your lab slips, can get imaging ordered for you, write referrals, make prescriptions, all of those things that the doctor can do, and same things as the nurse practitioner.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Johanna, I do know what it entails a little bit to be a mother, but and that's not what I'm going to ask you to describe. But I do want you to talk for a moment about why you were on the show today. What compelled you to be here?
Yes, and I'm not part of any movement or any side of a debate. And it sort of surprised me at the beginning when I knew that I was pregnant and having a family that the issue was so deep. And I was a scientist. I came from the EPA in Washington and in my background, and I knew I had to dig a bit deeper, that we all wish that we could go to just one place to answer these questions, that we could trust just one person. But unfortunately, there are conflicts of interest from drug companies and even from the government. And if you study history, you know that even as long ago as 1940, they thought that sterilizing people was a good idea. So I thought it's incumbent on me as a parent to do my research, and it was confusing. And so I sort of developed a systematic method for doing that, where I just looked at every vaccine and every illness that the vaccine was supposed to protect against and made an individual decision for each one.
Fantastic. And so three great perspectives. And I think probably let's start by talking about, you mentioned, Dr. Forsman, risks and benefits of vaccines. Can you kind of give your thoughts on that?
Well, I could give a very long answer to that. So I've been thinking about how do I edit myself, which is not one of my better my fortes.
We're going to watch you grow
here. Anybody out there knows. And so anyhow, first of all, I'd like to give some references beyond going to PubMed and the Cochrane database, which you can get many of the very Western peer-reviewed research that is referenced in some other books as well, too. And for people out there, I'd like you to develop an educated opinion. Now, it's difficult to develop an educated opinion in today's world because, as Mark Twain said, if you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. And if you read the newspaper, you're misinformed. And so, and that's true for a lot of things out there, is that I've even in my 20-some years of practice, I found my patients going from blank slates to horrifically misinformed. And I prefer blank slate. It's so much easier. When it comes to the references I would refer to of all the stuff that's out there, there's one beautiful book written by a doctor called Dissolving Illusions, which goes into the history of infectious diseases and really where did these how did we develop vaccines and what role did they play and what's the, makes the biggest difference, especially in infectious disease mortality. There's another very good book written by Neil Miller, Vaccine Safety Manual, that was updated in 2015. I recommend that book for anybody who wants to get some of diverse view of things, because nothing in these books, I think, is 100% perfect. I've never read a book that I would say that about. And then one other, it was the Thimerosal that was written in 2014, I believe, by Robert Kennedy, Let the Science Speak. It's called Thimerosal, Let the Science Speak. And I think I'd use that as my one thing that I'd kind of get across to the public, which is the role of public health departments are to try to make sure everybody falls in line and follows the recommendations. And I understand why they need to do that, because the slippery slope is once you realize there are problems, then you have to start questioning all of the vaccines. And for the most part, the powers that be don't want that. Thimerosal is a known neurotoxin. So let's go to where the science speaks, okay?
Right.
It's part of the flu vaccine still. It did get taken out of most childhood vaccines, but there's still a recommendation now from 6 months on to load your kid with mercury, injecting it into their brain, okay, into the rest of their body too.
And you're talking about the chemical Thimerosal.
Yeah. Thimerosal is a mercury preservative. And by the way, the science shows it's actually not a very good preservative. It doesn't help prevent infections as much as the contamination of the vaccines the way we thought it might. And furthermore, there's better, safer alternatives and to using it, or single-dose vaccines instead of multi-dose vaccines. And so the big question is, we have this epidemic of autism that's occurring, autism spectrum disorders. We know that the rate has historically been 1 in 10,000 births, and currently we know that that rate is somewhere between 1 in 66 to 1 in 150 as far as I can go through the data. So we're in this epidemic phase of neurological disorders, okay? And we have a current system which injects aluminum into our babies and mercury into our babies that absolutely biochemically plausibly can cause neurological injury. Mm-hmm. Nobody can even question that. It can. And so we're wondering, why are we doing this in the midst of the greatest epidemic? So the epidemics don't just mean infectious disease people. It's this epidemic is the neurological injuries that are occurring to our kids, which I want to be clear is much more complicated than just vaccines.
Right.
And it's much more complicated than just the MMR. So that's where the confusion has occurred, is that it's a much more complicated than just thimerosal. So, and it has to do with high fructose corn syrup and a whole bunch of other things out there in terms of the way our kids are eating
environment
and pollutants,
right,
and pesticides. Right. It's a very complicated subject, but it does need to be addressed. Why aren't we in this state of a almost complete arousal that our children are being essentially knocked off, and we continue to do something unquestioned that has a biologically plausible role in causing it, and here's the beauty of this, and it doesn't have to be there. Okay, so because of a profit margin issue, and that really makes you wonder. We're sacrificing the health of our children. And we don't need a double-blind trial. If something is biologically plausibly a problem, above all, do no harm, get it out of there, and it should have been gone decades ago. Mm-hmm. And so we now have to question, wow, public health and public safety may not be the only priority of what's happening out there. Mm-hmm. And that gets the ball rolling in terms of all the rest of the questions about vaccines.
Mm-hmm. And Johanna, you were going to kind of tag on here.
I wanted to say that for parents, this is what is confusing, mm-hmm, because it is kind of a lottery with your child. There's a genetic susceptibility that you have. So to parents, I would urge them to try and dig deeper, ask aunties, aunt grandparents, did they ever have a vaccine-related reaction in their family? Mm-hmm. Because I think that is the lottery that you take on as a parent when you go into the office to get a vaccine. You don't know that for your child that's not going to do harm.
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm likely that you may not see anything, but it's likely that also it will also cause some harm that you don't see. And we have had instances where children have been harmed and even killed after vaccines. So that is what parents struggle with when they go in. And it's a terrible position to be in. And I think we all feel very sorry for everybody facing that conflict every day with their young children.
You know, that's going to take us into two words that I think have been bantered about a lot. And there may be some confusion about what it is and how it works. And that's, you know, when we talk about herd immunity, mm-hmm, you know, what opponents of this stance would say is that, yes, and autism, as you pointed out, Dr. Forsman, could actually be the effect because of a number of different environmental factors, a number of different factors that have nothing to do with vaccines. And for the number of children that are protected, the risk, if you will, for a small number that would be harmed, it's like the greater good argument, right?
Well, there is that argument, and I understand that argument where it talks about drunk driving or seatbelts. Mm-hmm. You're not actually causing any harm to my child by forcing me to wear a seatbelt or them to wear a seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
You are potentially causing harm by forcing them to have vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's, in terms of putting one child another above another, I'm not putting my child above yours, but you in asking me to inject my child when I don't agree with that based on my scientific appraisal and parental instinct, say I don't want it, is forcing something.
And from your, yes.
And I think it's much more than just autism. I think that's just like the hot topic. I mean, we're talking about other neurological disorders.
Absolutely.
Like Guillain-Barré, having some kind of paralysis in an arm that may go away in a couple of days. It may not go away ever. And so it's a little bit more than just autism. That's just the hot topic to talk about. There are many other risks involved. And as I'm a parent of a two-year-old, and she can't tell me if she has a reaction to something. And so, you know, I went to Stanford School of Medicine, and I worked in the underserved and, you know, homeless communities of San Francisco, rural community migrant farm workers outside of Kern County. So I see a great reason for vaccinations. And I see the opposite side of it, too. And when I go into the doctor and the pediatrician, I find myself as a parent going, oh, my gosh, everything I learned, I'm kind of second guessing. And I know that, you know, one vaccine is probably safe, but I'm like, you know, have to put that trust that parents do in their doctors. And it's a very interesting thing because there's so many other things that can happen outside of, you know, autism alone.
Absolutely. If you just joined us, you're listening to Central Coast Voices here on KCBX, your public radio station. Today's show is part two of Vaccine Facts and Fallacies. It's a follow-up to part one that aired in 2015. Today, my guests present a view through a different lens, and they are Dr. Gary Forsman, physician and founder of Middle Path Medicine in Arroyo Grande, Jessica Joslin, who is a physician's assistant with Middle Path, and Johanna, who is a mother of four and also background in science and science research, is it?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you were going to say something, Dr. Forsman, about...
As always.
I do want to remind people you can call in at 781-3875.
The herd immunity is such a difficult subject because in many ways the current vaccine program may be the worst thing for herd immunity.
Explain that, please.
Because we know that, for instance, the mumps vaccines and the measles vaccines are so ineffective in that there's given the illusion that you're protected. And if you do have protection, for what length of time? Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, you're actually, like, for instance, even the MMR, the rubella component to it, is it would actually make more sense to catch rubella as a child and have lifelong immunity as compared to get the vaccine, because it's almost meaningless illness. Now, rubella is just a very mild rash and low-grade fever and very little mm-hmm. else. And so the biggest issue is, of course, if you're getting pregnant, you want to be immune.
Right.
And could that be one of the first things of women who want to get pregnant is say, hey, am I have test for rubella immunity? And if I haven't been exposed naturally, then get a vaccine if you're planning on getting pregnant, because that's the only time is congenital rubella syndrome where we're concerned. And so there'd be much more effective strategies that don't always play out, because we know people who don't always get vaccinated who should. But the greatest threat to herd immunity right now might be people getting vaccinated and thinking they're immune. What started this epidemic, we know, is that there's been multiple measles epidemics long before the Disneyland one, affecting, I think, around 160 people. The vast majority of people in these epidemics have been vaccinated appropriately. And so on, and some of them on the order of 99% vaccinated who mm-hmm. get this illness. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that the unvaccinated people are putting you at risk, when I'm wondering if the vaccinated people are putting my unvaccinated child at risk, because that's actually as valid a question.
So what you're saying is they could actually be carrying the illness without knowing it and thinking they're immune.
And having an atypical presentation, then you have to get into these live attenuated viruses, how they can recombine with other viruses in the body, and we can create all new strains. Mm-hmm. They're having this issue in India right now with the polio vaccines going up and up, and some kids getting 32 vaccinations. I mean, they're getting crazy numbers. And along with that, there's an high incidence of this thing called acute flaccid paralysis, which has many other. So as polio-related paralysis does go down with that many vaccines, other forms of paralysis are going way up, okay? So this is the other part of things. There is a time when they used a high-potency measles vaccine in Africa that's no longer available, and one out of six African children died of things other than measles, okay? And so we have clear studies showing that vaccines can suppress immunity. The reason the MMR is spaced away from everything else is because you have immune suppression for up to 6 months. So does these vaccines increase the rate of other illnesses? even if that one illness has decreased and increases the total load of infectious diseases that we're being exposing our other children to? Mm-hmm. It's actually a valid question. So yes, the herd immunity and what level of vaccination you need, that
right.
you hear 80%. Now it's up to 95 or 97%. And the reason the number is going up is because the vaccines aren't working very well. And we've kind of led to believe how wonderful these things are, and they have had their time and place and wonderfulness, by the way. But this takes us to one other part of this, which is the real difference that occurs in changing the course of infectious disease in our country really has come through sanitation and nutrition and those factors more so than vaccinations. And clean water, mm-hmm. sanitation, those make so much more of a difference. Because one other talking point on this is that illnesses like scarlet fever, who killed vastly more people than smallpox, okay, have decreased at the exact same rate and are now no longer a problem, and there's been no vaccine for them. Doesn't this bring to question that this dramatic decrease in mortality and complications from infectious disease has happened as child labor laws developed and as sanitation developed and all? And that's what's made the difference. And so, because even diseases that don't have vaccines, people, they've gone away in terms of their severity. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so this all takes into this idea that the vaccine program was what saved us all is actually quite an illusion. Okay. Not to quote the Dissolving Illusions book, but that's the whole idea.
Right.
And we have to relook at these things because there is a time and a place to get vaccines. I want to be clear about that. And especially in underserved populations and other things who do still have poor nutrition and do have more complicated illnesses, there is roles for vaccines. But it's not to be mandated in everybody. That's taking away a First Amendment right and just about any sense of common decency, as far as I'm concerned, because these are drugs, people. A vaccine is a drug, okay? And be very clear about that. It's more than just a live attenuated virus or a killed virus. It has adjuvants and antibiotics and proteins and albumins and other things in it. So we're injecting drugs into our children. And that's another thing that's missed on people, is that the drug approach to disease has been a very, very tenuous one. And so it brings up so many things. That does herd immunity occur better when we allow ourselves to get infections and when they're safe to do so? And the majority of things we're vaccinating against in our country, as long as the wealth divide, there goes another one. As long as things don't continue along the pathway where we are, where poverty rates are reaching the way they did in 1932, and so if we don't go back to that, then that's the real way to save our children, by the way, is to deal with something entirely different than vaccines.
And I want to give out our phone number for – he just stepped off of that podium
for a
moment. That was good.
Oh, man.
I don't detect any passion behind this at all. And if you've got passion and you want to call in and you want to ask a question of any of the three guests today, or you want to make a comment, you can call us at 781-3875. That's 781-3875. Johanna, I'm going to go over to you here.
I wanted to say to Gary's point about – I went to the film Trace Amounts that was showed in San Luis Obispo recently. Mm-hmm. And I saw quite a few people. Some I knew were involved in this debate quite heavily, and a lot of people weren't. And they almost had to skulk inside. They almost had headscarves over their head. They were embarrassed to be seen. And when I approached them, they said that they wouldn't tell their friends, their other parents in the school, that their children were unvaccinated. And I think that's so dangerous because it means that we can't talk openly about it and we can't share information. And these people said, you know, I think we should emigrate. I think it was very sort of reactionary, mm-hmm. a response to this film. And it surprised me because I felt like these people were actually taking care of themselves and not taking care of all the other children who couldn't speak, whose parents don't have that luxury. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's very, very important for us to consider the wider implications of our own actions here as parents.
Do we, by getting entrenched solidly in one absolute camp or another, totally excluding any fact or any idea of the other side, if you will, do we actually confine ourselves to limiting our own information? And you know, I it seems to me like there isn't an absolute. I mean, I am hearing in a lot of ways there are certain things that from one side or the other are absolutes, but there are many that are crossover. Right. And there are compromises in between.
Yes, and it's evolving constantly, which is the trouble, because who has time? Who has time in their day to really follow this? And because there's so much misinformation put out, you don't know who to believe as
now,
a parent.
Now, the film that you referenced actually was not about vaccines itself. Mm-mm. It was about the contents of the vaccines.
It's a wonderful film.
And very
film.
Much what you were talking about, correct. Dr. Forsman.
That's right. It's talking about a young man's journey to find out about mercury poisoning that he found in his body after receiving a vaccine.
And he was an adult.
He's an adult.
But did he receive a tetanus shot?
Yes. DTaP.
Yeah.
And his journey, it's basically detox his own body and to find out what was in the vaccine and what was in light bulbs and other things that had caused his poisoning.
And he was having a significant amount of symptoms that he had never had and was seeing every great doctor that he could get his hands on, and they were, you know, poo-pooing him and telling him it's all in your head, you're not having this, when he really was having these symptoms and wanted to have some relief from them.
When you talk about integrative medicine, you know, you're talking about integrating what you know from science, also what we know from the natural side, which is, you know, unfortunately, do you think that our science kind of excludes the fact that there are some things that we used to do pretty well before technology existed?
Yes. I mean, Western medicine is part of a holistic medical system, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's a part, though. And so, and it specializes in drugs and surgery, and that's why I'm emphasizing, let's understand the vaccine for what it is as a drug, okay, and that it has its potential positives, but like all drugs, it has potential negatives. And so, and I'm standing for people if they decide to get vaccinations, I want you to have the right to do that, just like I want to have the right to choose not to as well, because the implication is that it's superior or something else, and that there's nothing else to do. I'll give an example just from today.
Okay.
Where I have a guy who has very atypical neurological symptoms, and he's an annual flu vaccine person, including one very atypical neurological symptom that very much could have been from his flu vaccines. And of course, it's never been brought up to him before. It's a new patient that I saw today, and I said, you know, and this is the beauty of what you're asking, is that the research on flu vaccines, let's just use that, these annual injections of mercury and flu vaccine into your body have not been shown to prevent complicated flu. And this is one of the things when we get into the scientific medicine, go to the Cochrane database or go to middlepathmedicine.com and look at my reviews on flu vaccines, which I stuck to because it's one of the things I know the best. And the Cochrane database will tell you no matter what age group, there is significant publication bias in terms of what gets to the press, okay? And that when you look at all the data combined, including down to the six-month-olds, the flu vaccine in most trials is no better than a placebo. So why are we doing this? And science, and this is the beauty of this, true science, which is what Middle Path should be about, which is freedom of a belief system in the Western medical belief system, because unfortunately that's what I found even when I was listening to on the radio, is that these are high priests of the Western medical belief system talking to you, and that's dandy and all, but not what I was looking for when I went to medical school. I really have been my first bumper sticker on my car was "Back off, man! I'm a scientist." It's a Ghostbuster line, you know, which is one of the great movies out there, folks.
It's a wonderful movie.
And the reason I'm in integrative medicine is because I wanted the science of medicine and to look at what the best of things were out there. Because I said, listen, I wouldn't get any more flu vaccines because these atypical neurological things could be related to this. Let's do this. this form of testing to make sure there's no damage. And you know what? Here's an acute viral protocol, some vitamin D, C, and some herbs that works dramatically and wonderfully in the case of getting flu. So if he does get a flu in the future, he can treat it. Furthermore, and this goes into the long-term health I keep talking about, there's so much evidence that having illnesses with fever that during our lifetime actually train and educate our immune system, and having fewer feverish illnesses in your life increases your lifelong risk of cancer, okay, because you have a less educated immune system. So I can't go on.
What we're doing now is we're treating a fever right away so that we're not allowing people, whereas we used to maybe not have the resources, but treat it, what you're saying, after it got to a certain point.
They've actually shown with measles, if you treat the fever, you have a higher mortality. Okay. Mm-hmm. So going on into that, so much of our practices, like my doctor said, Tylenol, I mean, that's the leading cause of kidney failure in our country now. My doctor said Tylenol. So we have so much evidence out there that Western medicine has failed us in so many ways because it's a drug for everything. Okay. Instead of helping support your body's immune system dealing with these things, because let's face it, my children, would you ever want them to have a flu? You love these little creatures, and of course you don't want to have a flu. I get that.
But you don't want one yourself.
And I don't want one myself. But I'm not going to go through the risk to my neurological system and to theirs by giving them these vaccines, because I know I can help support their body through it, and it educates them and makes them stronger. And furthermore, the flu vaccine does not prevent complicated flu. It can decrease the incidence of flu in the society. I'm not saying, depending on how well it's matched that year and all those other fun little facts.
Right.
But it doesn't prevent complicated flu. So once again, we're deceiving ourselves into thinking how good these things are.
Does it reduce the symptoms of the flu when someone, because that's the big statement, that if you do get the flu, it'll be shorter duration, the symptoms will be lessened.
No, you can get less flus. That is true in the population who's vaccinated. But because of the mutating nature of influenza, you're never going to get enough herd immunity to ever make a difference, because our vaccines are so poorly matched most of the time anyway. So that's another.
And there are so many different ones. Johanna.
Yeah, I had a quick point to that, which is we actually did choose to get one of the meningitis vaccines for one of our children. We were up in a mountain town, about an hour and a half away from any medical establishment. She couldn't turn her neck. And this is an 18-month-old child. Mm-hmm. I've said, oh, goodness, this is where it really hits. Mm-hmm. I know I vaccinated for one of the meningitis strains. We got to the ER. They didn't care one bit that I'd had one of these meningitis vaccines, because there were 80-odd strains out there of meningitis. They were like, go straight for the spinal tap. Which we didn't do in the end. But it was a scary moment.
Sure.
But there's to the point, is that even this protocol will not protect you from everything. You cannot stop your child from getting illnesses. And indeed, it's a good thing that they do. But be honest with yourself about, are you going to have to go to work? Are they going to daycare right away?
Yeah.
You know, what kind of environment are you going to have once they do get sick, so that you can make adequate choices? If you're really not going to be there and you can't provide the nutrition and so on, you may want to consider more.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you're listening, just started to listen, you are joining Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your public radio station, at 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 91.7 Salinas de Paso Robles, 89.5 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web. On January 14, 2015, the day after it was first reported that visitors to Disneyland got measles and infected other people in California, Washington, Utah, and Colorado, the story spread globally, even though, according to January 23rd health advisory issued by the CDC, there were no source cases for the outbreak that had been identified. On June 29th, 2015, just slightly over 30 days after that, Senate Bill 277 was signed into California law by Governor Jerry Brown. The personal belief exemption to vaccination for religious and conscientious beliefs, two vaccines for children to attend school, was that bill in its entirety, and that goes into effect on July 1. So we're talking today about government control over patients' choices for health and treatments, decisions for children, you know, how they can be made responsibly and consciously by parents, and how choices by parents affect not only their own children, but does it affect others in the community? And we have a couple of calls that came in. If you are joining us and you would like to call in with a comment or a question, you can reach us at 781-3875. And Rick, are you there?
Yeah.
Hi. You had a question or a comment?
Yeah. I just tuned in a few minutes ago, and there was a mention of someone trying to find out about all the stuff that was in vaccines because they were affected by mercury. And I remember hearing maybe a couple of years ago some doctor on the radio saying that mercury was no longer used in vaccines and that they were all safe. And so I wanted to find out, is mercury still being used?
Yes. And so it got taken out of most of the childhood vaccines. There's still actually very low levels present in most of the vaccines, but the way we're sneaking it into our child's lives is through the influenza vaccine, which still has high levels of mercury. And if you do follow the current recommendations and get yearly vaccines, you're going to be going back to the mercury levels of what you had when you were dosing the kids with the mercury-laden vaccines before. Mercury is still part of the multi-dose influenza vaccines, and there are options of using a different form of preservative, because that's what thimerosal is for, or using single-dose vials. And yes, there is an expense to it, but the proposal is, since we know that this is a toxin, we shouldn't be injecting our children or our adults or anybody with it, because it makes no sense to do it.
And in the adult flu vaccine, it does exist, the small amount.
That's
still
right.
Because it's a multi-dose, is that for preserving effect?
And okay. It's basically only included for cost purposes.
Okay.
There are alternatives that drug companies could use,
and they do produce them without, correct?
That's right. And I wanted to tell parents, not when they go in, if they choose to use a vaccine, make sure that the nurse shakes the bottle. Don't use the very last dose in the bottle, because a lot of the preservative over time can
settle.
So just be vigilant when you go in.
That's good to note. Okay, thank you. Did that answer your question, Rick?
Well, mostly, but I'm just wondering, why haven't they re-informed the public that
they're
getting to? I mean, I know you guys are doing it, but the medical community has kind of given the impression that there's no longer anything harmful in there.
Well, it goes way beyond mercury, too, as far as aluminum, other adjuvants and things that are present, too, by the way. So the talking point is that you want a compliant public that's basically uneducated and just will accept whatever we tell them. So information, as you find, look at the world of elections today. You can find information makes very little difference anyways. But they're looking for a compliant public, and information like this might work against what they're looking for, so therefore you're not going to be informed of it.
And your point, Dr. Forsman, was look at more than one source of information.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This stuff is all out there. That's why I recommend looking at these books, looking at these websites. Go to Russell Blaylock's website. He has good information, especially on childhood exposures and what and it's maybe a little too doctory for some of you out there, but I thought it was a really good description of why we have to be careful of these things.
Thank you, Rick.
Well, thank you.
The National Vaccine Information Center is also a very good site that shows you exactly what the vaccine is, whether it contains thimerosal, what reactions there are, how many people have reported it, and explains about the childhood illnesses that it's trying to immunize against.
Great. And we've got a question from Thomas. Are you there, Thomas?
Yes, I'm here.
Question or comment?
Yes. First-hand experience. One of my wife's friends' husband is one of the people who doesn't believe in vaccines. And their daughter, as a child, he got a notation or a slip, and he got permission or authorization so his daughter did not have to have vaccines.
Right.
Going to elementary school.
Right. Yes.
And his daughter came down with measles, and it was a severe case of measles, and he did not take his daughter to a medical doctor for treatment of measles. He took his daughter to my mother-in-law, who is from a country other than the United States.
Okay.
And even after, and the daughter was all right. The daughter recovered. Daughter is perfectly healthy. She's now in her first year at University of California, Santa Barbara. And but even after not having inoculations and after having measles, this person continued not to give his daughter any inoculations of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
At my son's bris, and you probably know what a bris is.
Yes.
The same person came up to my wife and started ridiculing us for having our youngest son circumcised, saying that it wasn't natural, and saying that baby boys in Europe are not circumcised, and that if he had a son, he would not have his son circumcised.
Okay.
So obviously there's a school of thought that's on both sides of that issue. But in terms of inoculations, isn't there an overall medical opinion that all the pros and cons, generally, it's recommended to have a child inoculated for measles? So I'll let it go from there.
Okay.
But I just wanted
and
to
we'll,
make a comment about this one situation.
Okay, Thomas, and we'll let the professionals here answer that.
Okay.
Thank
all
you.
Right. Bye-bye.
I think when we decide that we're against vaccinations, any parent, and I'm not one of those parents, but when the decision is made, usually the parents think, okay, if my kid gets that, I'm taking that risk. So it's, and I know that the law has been passed for many years in California that when you decline a vaccine, you get educated from your healthcare provider, whether it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or in our case at our office, it's an hour, as to why you should or should not vaccinate and what qualifies for an exemption or a medical condition that you shouldn't get a vaccine. Has the kid been sick or not? And so interestingly, in this person's story, obviously the parents knew that their kid was going to be at risk for measles. And
felt that that was the lower risk.
Right. Mm-hmm. And took care of the kid at home. And mm-hmm. how he took care of that kid is, you know, obviously the parents' decision. Luckily, kid's fine. Going to college. Mm-hmm. No neurological problems.
And that goes back to what you were talking about, Dr. Forsman. And in before these vaccines were available, I mean, I remember in my day we had measles parties and we had mumps parties and
chicken pox parties.
And, you know, the whole point was it was exciting when someone got chicken pox during the summer because you got it out of the way before the school year, right?
Right.
Moms
yes.
were just gaga for that one. So, you know, and there were children that had very bad mm-hmm. effects from those illnesses. Not all of them went through it groovy with a couple of spots, and that was it.
Right.
So,
but did any of them die?
This is actually an example of a successful case where, yes, and I, you know, that the now we have at least one person with lifelong measles immunity, which is not acquired through the measles vaccine. And so,
what you're saying is once people get measles, they're not going to get it again.
No,
they're naturally immunized.
Because, yes, and like I was saying earlier, nobody wants our kids to get sick, except for when we're taking them to parties to get sick, which, again, was back to be normal. And see, to most of today's moms and dads, that sounds horrible.
Oh, it does. And so, I know.
Wouldn't do that. No, actually, you did that because, you know, you want to get chicken pox at a convenient time. And get natural immunity. And so in just using chicken pox as an example is a benign childhood illness and a well-nourished population again. And I remember getting chicken pox. No, it wasn't fun. And so
But you will develop lifelong immunity. Now, when we have the interesting outcome of getting children varicella vaccines, sorry, chickenpox vaccines, is that it does decrease the circulation of the virus in the population. And what they found is we've done this, is that now probably all of us who've been exposed to the past, as it's, that virus circulates, it probably kind of re-educates our immune system mm-hmm. as we go through. So the one of the consequences of the childhood varicella vaccine, sorry, chickenpox vaccine, has been a great increase in shingles. Mm-hmm. So now talk about a beautiful business model here. So we can now give a vaccine and hit the kids, cause more shingles, and come up with a vaccine for that,
shingles.
Which, by the way, doesn't work very well. So once again, we see that there's a huge business model. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and we haven't even talked about one of my favorite subjects, which is the vaccine adverse event reporting system, which is taken the pharmaceutical industry. People, this is the greatest business model ever, where they get all the profits from all the manufacture of these vaccines, and you and I pay for every complication. Mm-hmm. That is just brilliant.
It's lobbying
to the thing. Mm-hmm. So you have an industry that is can make drugs, inject them into your kids with absolute zero liability, and we will pay for it. And that's the current system we're in. That is fraught with danger, by the way. And so what the caller actually showed us was an example of, unfortunately, somebody getting measles, and I'm sorry if she was sick, but she did recover fully, which will happen in our society. One of the things that was brought up in another show was that, across the world, measles can still be a fatal illness, but that's a malnutrition and all kinds of other things that are going into that. But in our country, it will not be if it's appropriately attended to.
Mm-hmm. Joanna.
Yes. One of our inputs in deciding not to do the measles vaccine was the fact that children, when they went to college, weren't adequately immunized against that disease if they'd been vaccinated. Children,
meaning they'd outlasted the effectiveness?
Lessened, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They had lessened immunity to that by getting the vaccine. So for my mind, I had to be comfortable with my child getting measles. And I looked at the likelihood of him or her getting measles. I found it very, very low at that time. Even now, I suggest it's very, very low. And this notion that we can protect our children, through vaccinating everybody is really a spurious one, because there are people coming into the country all the time with measles. Mm-hmm. So I had to be comfortable with them getting measles, and I had to look at it long term in terms of, if they do, great, because luckily, I could provide them good nursing care at home, and I could nurse them through it, and they will have lifelong immunity. And I think, as a parent, that's a hard thing to shoulder, mm-hmm. especially in my case, where my in-laws are doctors, and they weren't always that supportive of a decision. And so you have to be quite strong and have conviction in terms of, am I capable of carrying this through? Am I capable of, in some cases, fighting family? Can I find a doctor who will support me?
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. I'm Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX FM, Central Coast Public Radio, from Salinas to Ventura and around the world at www.kcbx.org. If you're just joining us and want to hear today's entire show, it'll be available on our website at kcbx.org. And then you go to Programs and Central Coast Voices. It'll be available probably tomorrow. Dr. Gary Forsman, Jessica Jocelyn, who is a physician's assistant, and Johanna, mother of four and a scientist who's done research on the immunizations for herself and for her children, are here. If you are interested in bringing your voice to our conversation, we have about 10 minutes, and you can call us at 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. And, you had mentioned, Johanna, about the vaccines losing their effectiveness.
Yeah.
I've also heard that some of these illnesses in adults are really much more difficult, mm-hmm. and then it does become much more threatening to their health, because they may have other aspects of their health that are now they're compromised. Is that true or is that a myth?
I would say it's true. Your immune system does wax and wane, and when you get natural immunity from being exposed to something, those can be lifelong. There's all kinds of factors that involved our immunity and how many insults we get, how many illnesses we get, all kinds of things, exposures, toxins. And there's been a few vaccines that they've gotten it to last for a long period of time. But, you know, if we vaccinate all these kids before they're five, by the time they're in their 20s and 30s, there is a risk that if something happens and these viruses come back, that their immune systems aren't going to be primed, ready, and educated to take mm-hmm. on the viral assault.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And we have Anne, are you there?
Hello?
Anne? Did you have a question or comment? Hi, thank you for joining
us.
Yes,
thank you. I do. I wanted to ask a question about medical exemptions.
Uh-huh.
And I wondered, one of my aunts had got polio from the polio vaccine a number of years ago, and that was a vaccine reaction. So I guess she maybe has some type of genetic component that might have been passed on, like to me, to my grandchildren. And I wondered how do you get a medical exemption? What are the things you look at? What kind of proof do you have to have? Because she died and, there aren't any medical records for a certain amount of the information in our family about people having negative reactions to vaccines.
Good question, Anne.
Great question.
Yeah, that is a very good question, and I don't know the legal ramifications. So first of all, I'm not a lawyer, and maybe a lawyer would be better to answer that question. What I do look at is like anything else. If if a patient reacted to ibuprofen, you would never force them to have ibuprofen, mm-hmm. okay? And so that sounds as obvious as anything else. Nobody's going to go in your home and force you to have that. The concerns are nowadays is that we will be forcing mm-hmm. children with documented vaccine reactions to actually get these drugs injected into them even when there's proof that there was a febrile or a seizure response to it. So that is my concern when we start mandating things. Mm-hmm. And so is that we are now, of course, this is just like the war on drugs. It's really a war on people. This is mm-hmm. placing doctors and patients at almost at odds
in terms of an adversarial
mm-hmm. position, because we're getting the legal system involved, and it shouldn't come to that. Just like the last guy, it should be your choice to have a circumcision or not, and nobody should be going into your home and telling you not to or to. I mean, obviously. So on that order, that is, in terms of the idea is to discuss it with your doctor, and the doctor can write for a medical exemption. What latitude I have and what degree mm-hmm. to make it legal, I'm sorry, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So I get this question, and as I go into my pediatrician's office, I ask because I want to know what my colleagues are saying, and the fact is that the legislature doesn't have it written in what qualifies as an exemption. It does say family history, but like you said, how do you prove that? We could have anybody come into our office and say, well, after
I
have a family history mm-hmm. of everybody getting diabetes after getting the MMR and these things happen and people come to our office and those things are hard to prove. And, SB 277 says that based on family history, we can write an exemption on that, but there is no clear definition as to what that means. And in previous years, to write a true, like, permanent medical exemption has been almost ridiculously hard. You literally have to be on cancer, getting chemotherapy, and that immune compromised. Mm-hmm. And to prove that your child has a severe compromised immune deficiency disorder is extremely hard. We can't do it even when your kid has gotten a little bit of Guillain-Barré. The CDC is saying, well, that's not enough. You still need to vaccinate them. And there's even things that are coming down that I've been reading that are coming from the state level and from the CDC and the federal level saying, well, there's not even enough eggs in these vaccines to cause an allergic reaction. So if the parents are saying they're allergic to eggs, still give them the vaccines. And it's really, when I talk to my colleagues, we all don't know. And I have a lot of colleagues who are just, they won't even fancy the idea of an exemption. They just say, if you're not vaccinated, we can't even see you because it's just too controversial. And a lot of the healthcare providers that I speak to, they they're afraid to stand on either side of the fence, you know, and so they just kind of take the side with the CDC.
And with that, then, you know, in answer, and we lost Anne, but in answer to that, the law goes into effect in July, but we're not in July yet. So, you know, it really is about getting a hold of your senators, getting a hold of political figures about, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, what is this law doing? And, you know, whose concerns there are. It's not... I think what you're saying is there are still voices here.
There are.
Hopefully.
And
yeah.
There is in any scientific, anybody, and I want to emphasize from previous, if you understand science, you understand the verdict isn't in. So anybody who tells you that we do know that there is a consensus, I can tell you how many consensuses there's been in medicine that have been absolutely wrong. Actually, usually when I hear consensus, I know it's wrong. And so because that's medicine. There is very few actual things you can come to consensus on, you know.
Okay. And thank you, Anne, for calling. I'm sorry we lost you. And we're going to Nancy. Nancy?
Hello?
Hi. Did you have a question?
Oh, yeah. I have a few questions.
Okay. We've got a short amount of time, Nancy. So.
Okay. I'll be real fast. Okay. Now, I have a PhD in nutrition. I'm a registered dietitian. My daughter is a lawyer, and I gave her the book Make an Informed Vaccine Decision, and she did not vaccinate either of her children, who are now 4 and 2. What book do you recommend to give to parents, prospective parents, so that they can see the pros and cons, and is this the best book, or do you recommend a different book?
I can't give you one answer, unfortunately. I think start with the National Vaccine Information Center online, because that will give you a sort of broad picture. And then I think you're going to have to take what your doctor provides you so you know what the pro-vaccine lobby is talking about. Look at motivations there in terms of who's releasing the information. And do that on the other side too. And say, there's a book out called What Your Doctor Won't Tell You. And then at the extreme, there's immunization or vaccination. Vaccination is not immunization, and the sanctity of blood. There are sort of scary titles like that. But I think you'll get a general sense. But I haven't been able to find one book that I can reliably say that is the answer. And I think that's one of the problems.
And I think, Nancy, if I've heard anything from a theme today from the three people that are sitting with me, it's that you cannot go to just one source and come up with an answer for yourself. It's much more complicated than that. You need to look at a wider variety of issues. And so it's going to take some research.
And I still like the vaccine safety manual as well. But, again, none of these sources are perfect. I want to be clear.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Thank you. And one more question here from
Mandy.
Mandy, are you there?
Hello, yes.
Hi. We've got just a short amount of time. Did you have a question?
Okay, yes. I have mom friends that act like my 3-year-old unvaccinated son is a threat to their 3-month-old babies and that kind of thing. I was wondering, aren't newly vaccinated kids shedding the diseases more than my non-vaccinated kid would be? Like, wouldn't they be more of a threat to, you know, like infants that haven't been vaccinated?
Okay, well, let's let our panel answer that.
I know for sure that in the polio virus, that was the case.
Correct. The biggest concern, actually, is the effect on the immune system of the kids that are vaccinated. And what you're going through is unfortunate. You just tell your friends to stop watching Fox News, and they'll be fine, because they're the ones that are driving the hate and fear thing. And when you see people in that mode, just let them be, you know. But no, your child is not a threat to them. That's just this. The way we sell drugs as a doctor, and I want you to understand this, is that, a doctor will tell you, take this drug or you will die. And that's not true, but it sells it better. And that's what's happening with the vaccines. We have to sell it in a fairly dramatic way to convince people to do it. So that's why people are afraid, and just allow them to have their fear.
I want to thank my guest today. We've run out of time. An excellent topic. I want to thank Dr. Gary Forsman, Middle Path Medicine in Aurora Grande, Jessica Jocelyn, who is physician's assistant with Middle Path Medicine, and Johanna, who has joined us, and everyone who called in with questions and comments. Obviously, this is a big topic. If anything, please do your research, do a lot of reading, and thank you for joining us on Central Coast.